You're listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. This week, we're exploring the future of secularism with Georgetown University professor Jacques Berlinerblau. He's the author of several books, including How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. Now, secularism is often confused with personal beliefs like secular humanism or atheism. That's not what we're talking about today. We're focused on another meaning, the political philosophy, the one that's intended to protect the state from the church and vice versa. Earlier, Berlinerblau described the events that led to an erosion of this political philosophy in American civic life, the culture wars. He points to an aggressive ideological agenda and strategic communications approach used by a religious right political movement, one that also had a legal arm, and with it, a judicial philosophy. Let's get back to our conversation. Now, we have an election taking place in which the next 4 years will absolutely be impacted by the leader of this country, the president of the United States. But it is also going to be impacted by the courts. And you mentioned the court. We now have Amy Coney Barrett, a conservative Catholic woman who has avoided actually answering a series of questions about her judicial philosophies in the Supreme Court hearings. This week, there is going to be renewed focus on a particular case that will again lift up the entanglement of when taxpayer dollars flow into a faith-based agency that manages foster care, in this instance in Philadelphia. The religious rights of the individual seeking to obtain that service, a foster parent, do her religious rights get trumped by the religious rights of the taxpayer-funded agency that seeks to operate as a proxy for the state?
Let me go back one step, all right? We talked about France very quickly.
Sure.
Right? One thing that France has that we don't have is a robust tradition of thinking about secularism or what they call laïcité, right? So, I mean, from the time of Napoleon, right, the French are thinking very carefully about the proper relationship between the state and religion. In the United States, separation of church and state, as the jurist Noah Feldman pointed out, it doesn't really become an issue until the end of the 19th century in some Mormon cases, and then it explodes mid-century in a variety of cases, you know, Abington Township, cases about taxpayer-funded monies to school jurisdictions for bus programs and what have you. So first problem, in the United States, we do not have a robust tradition of thinking about secular America, believe it or not. It's impoverished compared to what you might see in France or even India, right? I mean, India, since the drafting of the Constitution, Indians have been thinking about how religion, right, and how the Indian government must interact. We don't have that, right? So we kind of lack a lot of resources. We're so used in the United States to thinking that our liberal democracy is the most advanced, the most sophisticated, the most. It's absolutely not true when we think about separation of church and state, secularism, and the Constitution, right? Think about how few words there are in the religion clauses, right? What is it, 36 words or something? That's it, right? That's supposed to guide a nation of 320 million people. So we talked about how the Christian right was doing all these brilliant and, to my mind, kind of sinister things, but nothing totally illegal per se, though there were some things that are deeply upsetting. One of the things they were doing was just exploring judicial ideas that would lead them to be able to say to Americans, we just want the individual to be able to make his or her choice. We don't want the state to tell an individual what they can do with state funding. I'm thinking about the school choice and the school voucher cases, right?
Right.
Instead of the state saying there must be separation between church and state, let's wipe that off the table. Let's do something much more democratic. Let's let every American decide what they want to do with whatever amount of aid the United States is willing to give to each taxpayer. That's brilliant stuff, Amber-Reed. I mean, that takes a long time to think through and work through the courts and set up the argument so it gets to the highest court in the land. And that type of reasoning, like, let's just leave it to the individual to decide, right? It's an individual decision, given that taxpayer monies are going to schools anyhow, right? It's that type of cleverness, which has not been matched by a corresponding counter-intellectual force by secularists, which I think is why we're in the space that we're in right now. And what American secularism needs, oh my gosh, it needs a diversity movement and it needs a youth movement. It needs those two things, right? It needs to be led. I think it has to abandon on my generation. You're much, much younger than I am, Amber-Reed Khan, but my generation, I mean, we're done, all right? We've tried and we've failed. The future of American secularism is diversifying it very, very quickly, making it much more feminine, right? Making it much less white. And having people that do what conservative Christians did for decades, which is train people like Amy Coney Barrett. I was reading an article about how she was groomed for this position, essentially, for a quarter century. I mean, think about that. Think about the discipline, right? The financing, the long-term visioning that creates an Amy Coney Barrett. And there's nothing that I see comparable amongst those that are interested in secular issues in the United States.
What is it that you hope for with the next administration? If it is a Biden-Harris administration, what positive step could you see them taking as it relates to restoring or increasing kind of an awareness of the value of secularism?
Yeah, it's a good question. Another book, which I didn't mention that I've co-written, is about African-American, Jewish-American relations. And I was talking to my co-author, Professor Terrence Johnson. We interviewed one another. And one of the questions we asked was, how does secularism read in the African-American community? Mm-hmm. And Professor Johnson's view was, it doesn't read well, Jacques. It's seen as atheism. It's seen as this white thing.
Mm-hmm. And male. And it's seen very male.
So yeah. You ask, like, what's the next step, right? So what is the next step if the coalition that brings Biden-Harris to defeat Donald J. Trump, right, is a coalition of religious folks of the left, and those folks have nothing but suspicion for secularism because they see it in terms of the adjectives that I just described, then secularism really has a challenge, right, because it doesn't have a natural ally or a natural friend in the religious left. I know you don't like the term, but I think heuristically it's kind of useful. So I don't know. Secularism needs a really major rethink. Given what we're facing right now, we're facing the COVID crisis, obviously. We're facing economic doom. One wonders, maybe secularism should sit down for a year or two, right? Maybe right now isn't the moment to fare forward on these religious issues, right? Given that the COVID crisis and secularism intersect in only one place I can think of, that's the question of whether churches should be allowed to congregate in an era of COVID, to which secularism and I say, no, absolutely not. It's a public health crisis, right? So that's a place for secularism to roll up its sleeves and say, we want to get in on this issue, right? Because it's a good secular issue and it's a good American issue because it's a public health issue.
Well, I was going to say science. I mean, when you said secularism and COVID, where my mind went is to the number of books on my shelf right now that speak to secularism and science and finding ways to build support for science, particularly when confronting existential challenges like the climate. I want to back up for one second. I just asked you about a Biden-Harris administration. Let me ask, if we have the reelection of a Trump-Pence administration, what would you hope for? The president has recently announced that he was no longer a Presbyterian, that he was a non-denominational Christian. Vice President Pence is an evangelical Catholic. Both have demonstrated not just an affinity for, but a real focus on elevating and amplifying a certain, not all, certain religious voices in policy matters. So thinking about the question, if the outcome is different,
then secularism's woes will exponentially increase if there's another 4 years of Trump-Pence. These have been very, very difficult years for American secularism for obvious reasons, right? And that's not just a leadership problem. That's just the sheer magnitude of the force of this government and its opposition to secularism and its perfervid desire to dismantle whatever bricks are left in this wall of separation, which, as I pointed out earlier, was kind of taken down about 20 years ago. You mentioned science. Here's another definition we throw around for secularism. Secularism believes that all public policy should be driven by science, rationality, and data. That's a definition that works well when you try to understand what exactly secularism is. So let's think about that. The harm that has been done to science under the previous administration is absolutely flabbergasting. I think we can all agree as we listen, as we see the complete collapse of the CDC, for example, right? I mean, the thing was set up to deal with what has happened.
Well, you're speaking specifically about the pandemic response task force that was disbanded.
The inability to listen to science coming from government scientists, right? So we're just going to get more of that. I don't see a singular secular voice within the Trump administration. I don't see any support from secularists of any stripe. So I think we're in for a world of hurt on the secular side were this administration to be voted in. Would you disagree with me on that?
I'm not going to proffer an opinion. I think that there is a whole host of issues in which the voices that are influencing policy are not coming from the rubric that you just outlined of data, rationality, and science. And I think that from a policy perspective, that rubric, many would argue, should apply not just to science, but to the way in which we approach tackling public policy issues, whether you're talking about food insecurity in the wake of a pandemic in which you have an unprecedented number of families food insecure. That rubric should drive how we distribute that common good.
In a Biden-Harris administration, unequivocally, science, rationality, and data are going to be the drivers of quotidian policy formation. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And if you accept that as one of the definitions of secularism, it's going to be a much better 4 years for secularism. I have no compunction about saying that's going to be what happens.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the question one more time. What is secularism in the United States? I know there's a listener out there going, okay, he keeps using the word secularism, and I'm reading about France, and I'm reading a lot about France and the way it gets invoked as a way of responding to extremism, but I'm not understanding what it means in the United States.
The American secular tradition, which is a form of secularism, has always been predicated on an idea of separation of church and state. All right. That is where it grew in the late 19th century. It blossomed in the 40s, 50s, 60s, Engel versus V. Vitale, these types of cases, right? It routed its political action not through the legislative branch, but through the judicial branch. It was very based on court victories, not popular victories, Amber Reed, and that came back to bite us, right? So the victories of secularism mid-century were generally unpopular, and they were commandeered by the United States Supreme Court, right? So what happened was when that intellectual group died or moved on or left, right, you were left with decisions that were not particularly popular but very powerful, and then the Christian right set about systematically undermining them. And what secularists learned in the worst possible way is this principle of separation of church and state. So I don't want to be ambiguous. You say I'm being ambiguous, which I think is what American secularism is built on, right? Had no clothes, like nobody was willing to defend it, right? I always tell some of my colleagues, you go out on Twitter and you advertise a secular event, all right? You're going to get 7 likes, my friend, all right? Not a popular thing, right? Secularists aren't popular.
I got to have a couple conversations now with some young secularists out there defending their belief system, because that is something that I'm seeing emerge, at least among Generation Z, an embrace of a whole set of values, political values and ideas that are knit together not by a doctrine of a religious belief system, but by secular values. when you talk about separation of church and state, what brings to mind for me is back in the day when I was an organizer working with faith-based groups, and I used to talk about separation of church state, I used to have folks come back at me and say, you know, that was just a line in a letter.
Right.
That was just a line in a letter. If it was that important, why not put it in writing, in a governing document?
So let's review, right? The professor in me is coming out now, right? The words secularism or wall of separation or separation of church and state are not in the Constitution, all right? They're in a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists, mm-hmm. which nobody noticed for seven decades, and then didn't notice again for another seven decades until the 1940s. And then all of a sudden, it became, in everybody's mind, part of the Constitution. This is what you're referring to.
When I point that out, that in fact, it is Baptists that lift up the religious liberty that comes from the protection of that separation of the wall between church and state, what I would hear is, but that was a problem of the past, not the future.
There are different types of secularisms, Amber, right? So the Indian system is interesting, where the state says we're going to treat every religious group equally. Maybe that's how I always talk about rebranding secularism in the United States, right? Some people say, just call it pluralism for the love of God. Call it pluralism. Don't call it, everyone hates this word secular. That's one way. The Indian model is interesting, but what do you do with like non-believers, right? That's a big problem. If the state says we love religion, all religions are good, and we fund every religion equally, well, that's not fair to folks who are non-believers or agnostic. That's one problem. Also, what do you do with religious groups that are completely off the reservation, right? Groups with racist ideology.
One thing that I've heard a lot of people talk about when they think about and wrestle with secularism is it fundamentally that we need secularism to negotiate the pluralism?
You got it. All right. So this is how I always describe secularism to my students, right? And I think maybe you'll laugh. I hope you laugh. Secularism is like a referee. Who likes the referee, right?
Nobody likes the referee.
Nobody likes the referee, right? You know, you see those like soccer clips of the referee running for his life in various countries because he or she made a call Secularism is this thing that says to the state, this is how far you can go, and you can't go there because then you're messing on people's liberty of conscience or freedom. But it also says to religious groups, for the love of God, could you not congregate during a pandemic because you're going to kill us, right? Who likes that entity, right? So we, the long-suffering secularists, right? Put it this way. If you want to be a secularist, right, be prepared to have like no honor anywhere. Like wherever you go, people dislike you. They think you're dumb and they think, right? So, you know,
you're reminding me actually of a feeling thermometer that I believe a poll, the Pew Research Center do when they check the feeling thermometer about religious groups in America. And I always remember that atheists and Muslims generate the coolest temperatures. You're reminding me of that actually for some reason.
Secularism, yeah, it's not meant to have broad support or fans or like a web page and a billion followers, right? It's a small regulatory mechanism. It's small, right? It covers the waterfront. That's its only beat. It's got like one thing it does, which is regulating relationships between church and state. That's what secularism is. What the Christian right did, Amberine, and this was brilliant, is it made secularism into like Mephistopheles. It made it into this dragon. It made it into this thing that was going to, you know, destroy your lives and take your religion away. That was brilliant, right? Secularism is a boring bureaucrat in stained trousers. It has very, very little power. It's a kitten, actually, if you ask me, right? Because it's got no power presently, right? But I think what secularism is supposed to do is really important. It plays this referee function, and it's necessary for a liberal democracy to thrive. Except it's been eviscerated, right? And I think these are some of the issues that this next generation I keep speaking about, mm-hmm. right? They're going to have to think that through in a way that my generation, the one prior to me, just completely, they didn't see that, right? So I'm just here kind of, you know, screaming fire, right? But I wish people would listen, but we need to train a generation, get them when they're 23, 24, 25, make sure it's diverse, make sure it looks like America, make sure it's mostly women, right? And have them rethink these issues, like a complete rethink of what secularism is and what secularism does.
Jacques Berliner-Blau is currently the Rabbi Harold White Professor and Director of the Center for Jewish Civilization, the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Berliner-Blau has published on a wide variety of issues, including secularism, religion, and politics. Berliner-Blau touches on France's history of secularism. So we're going to end this week's episode with a segment that originally broadcast a few years ago with my predecessor, Interfaith Voices founder, Maureen Fiedler. And then later, we check in with Maureen to find out how she's coping with all this election stress and how she fills her days at the Loretto Mother House in Kentucky. That's coming up. Stay with us. You're listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices, a listener-supported media nonprofit working to explore the beliefs shaping our world.